2007. Special thanks to the Palestine Center for Public Policy. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
One in five Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us don't know how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma and advance mental health. Visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Chris Hedges joins us to talk about the need for an independent political action.
What does it take to defend ourselves? Chris Hedges thinks not voting for the Democratic Party.
Bruce Ratner joins us to talk about his new book, Early Detection.
This is a significant, significant contribution to humanity. Just like his older brother Michael Ratner made a significant contribution in the field of constitutional rights, Bruce Ratner has made one in the field of early detection of cancer.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The growing repression and censorship in the United States is manifest daily. Already, some 3,000 students have been arrested, and many of their pro-Palestinian encampments on college campuses have been violently closed down. The so-called paper of record, the New York Times, has instructed reporters not to use the words genocide or ethnic cleansing. Journalist Chris Hedges has been removed from the Real News Network for interviewing Dennis Kucinich, the independent candidate for Congress in Ohio, and for not supporting the presidential candidacy of Joe Biden. The necessity for independent political action, independent of both the Republican and the Democratic parties, is the lesson that many social activists are drawing. Journalist Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report coined the phrase "the more effective of two evils" in describing the Democratic Party. Significant social change comes from organizing people independently. The rise of the CIO, the civil rights movement, and the movement to end the war in Vietnam are illustrations of that truth. In appreciating the role of the Democratic Party, social activists are increasingly concluding that independent political action now will help us during the next presidential administration. We speak today with Chris Hedges, the journalist and author, about the collapsing media landscape and what happened to him at the Real News Network, as well as how we can preserve journalism. Chris spent two decades as a foreign correspondent, serving as the Middle East Bureau Chief and Balkan Bureau Chief for the New York Times, where he was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. He's the author of 14 books, including War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which he co-wrote with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, and also The Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Chris, please tell us what the Real News Network is and what happened to you over there.
So the Real News Network is primarily has one funder, T.M. Scruggs. He told, according to the editor-in-chief, Max Alvarez, that if the Real News did anything in his eyes to contribute to the election of Donald Trump, he would pull the funding. That's just an inverted way of saying elect Joe Biden. There's been a certain animus between Scruggs and myself. I had written a column for Shearpost where he had also contributed, where I defended the writer Alice Walker from charges that she was an anti-Semite. He demanded that that column be removed or he would cut his funding. Bob refused to remove the column, and the funding was cut. I had posted an interview with Dennis Kucinich, a former Democratic member of the House, former Democratic mayor of Cleveland. He is running for a House seat in Ohio in the current election cycle as an independent. That segment or show was taken down from the Real News site, and then my show was terminated. The reason I was given was that I jeopardized their nonprofit status. There was nothing that I said in that show or any other show.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk more about the attacks on pro-Palestinian protesters with the president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Co-founder and president Salam al-Mariati joins us to talk about his efforts to hold university officials and law enforcement accountable for allowing attacks against pro-Palestinian protesters.
We'll also speak with graduate student Javier Fitzsimmons-Cruz, who was arrested after the encampment was torn down.
He vividly describes the situation at the NYU encampment, and after all, he ran from his arrest to defend his dissertation.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
As the Israeli-Gaza war rages on, protests have spread throughout American campuses as students oppose Israeli military onslaught and the tragic humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Students have demanded a ceasefire, an end to U.S. military support for Israel, and that universities divest from Israel. In response, university officials have suspended and expelled students, banned pro-Palestinian student groups, called in the police, and sent mixed messages on students' right to free speech. At UCLA, a group of counter-protesters launched a violent attack on pro-Palestinian protesters. To address these critical issues, we've invited Salam al-Mariati, president and co-founder of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where he oversees MPAC's groundbreaking civic engagement, public policy, and advocacy work. Salam al-Mariati is an expert on Islam in the West, Muslim reform movements, human rights, democracy, national security, and Middle East politics. He's spoken at the White House and on Capitol Hill and has represented the U.S. at international human rights and religious freedom conferences. He's very active in interfaith dialogue, which is where I first met him in the wake of 9/11 in my capacity as a leader of Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace. Salam, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you, Stephen. Always good to hear from you.
What's happened at UCLA has gained national attention. On May 3rd, your organization, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, sent a letter to the Department of Education and its Office for Civil Rights calling for an investigation into the violent April 30 attacks on pro-Palestinian student protesters at UCLA by pro-Zionist agitators. In response, the Office of Civil Rights promptly initiated an official investigation into the incident under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Salam, please describe those attacks for our listeners and tell us what's the current status of the investigation.
Sure. I'd also like to first describe the context of the encampments themselves. I attended four of them, Vanderbilt, George Washington, UCLA, and USC. All of them were peaceful. In fact, a recent study from a center at Princeton said that of the 3,700 encampments established throughout the country on universities' property, 95% had been considered peaceful. So yes, there was a handful of incidents, I'm sure, where there was some harassment, some intimidation, some vandalism, maybe breaking a window here or there. But when the issue of the Vietnam War and the protests took place there, the civil rights protests on campuses, I met with Eric Holder, the former attorney general, and he told me he occupied a building when he was a college student. So this is part of campus tradition. This is an American tradition. And these encampments have been very, very peaceful from my standpoint and from what the study from Princeton University has stated. And my argument to law enforcement when they talk about these encampments is there's more violence, there's more harassment, there's more assault, there's rape reports after football games. Are they going to go and close down football games in university property? No, of course they're not. So to suggest that these encampments and these students are violent is ridiculous. So let's just establish that premise to begin with. Then what happened on April 30th, as you stated, Stephen, is that pro-Zionist, anti-Palestinian agitators were allowed to enter UCLA without any confrontation or protection by law enforcement, whether it's LAPD, LA Sheriff, or University of California Police Department. None of them provided any protection for the students, and there are reports that they threw a bag of rodents into the encampment. There were scenes of people being beaten up by pipes. There were assaults. There were fireworks launched into the encampment. The students had to go to emergency without any emergency medical group providing any assistance for them at the encampment. It was students who took students to the emergency ward at UCLA Medical Center. Law enforcement did nothing, and they stood back as these pro-Zionist, anti-Palestinian agitators had their way with the Palestinian peaceful encampment protesters. So we filed a complaint with the Department of Justice, with the Department of Education. I met with the Attorney General and the FBI Director last week, and we demanded that if we are a country that is bound by the United States Constitution, which makes all of us Americans, that's what makes us an American, our pledge to the Constitution, and your job, Mr. Attorney General, Mr. FBI Director, is to defend the Constitution. There's a violation of the First Amendment. Now, the FBI Director started talking about, well, we have to be worried about violent extremists, you know, using these public events that are being motivated by foreign governments to attack Americans. I said, well, that already happened. It happened on April 30th. So the whole national security agenda, obviously, is skewed and singles out Muslims and Arabs and pro-Palestinian people as a threat, to the extent that Ilan Pape, an Israeli historian, was held up in Michigan at an airport for hours, interrogated simply because he's pro-Palestinian. It's getting ridiculous what's happening in our country, and that is why we filed the complaint, and that's basically the event that happened on April 30th, and we're continuing to demand investigation of law enforcement, of the civil rights that was violated against these pro-Palestinian protesters, and of the criminal conduct of these pro-Zionist agitators that launched the violent attack on April 30th, including, by the way, I believe there was a report there was members of the Proud Boys that are also engaging in these assaults against pro-Palestinian protesters.
Do you know the status of the Office of Civil Rights investigation? Have you or others that you know of been interviewed for that investigation?
No, I have not. I wasn't there, so I probably would not be in that question. But I do believe that the investigation is going on at this moment, and there are people being queried by the Department of Education. I do believe also I received an email from the chief of staff of the FBI that they are also considering an investigation, and we're pressing for that as well.
Well, Salam, as Steve mentioned, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, or MPAC, described what happened at UCLA as, quote, an unprecedented attack on UCLA's pro-Palestinian encampment by pro-Zionist instigators and contractors linked to the Israeli Defense Forces. Please describe what MPAC has learned about the agitators who attacked the pro-Palestinian protesters.
What we have found out is many of these people had nothing to do with UCLA, with the faculty, with the students. And in fact, according to my colleagues in the Jewish community, they have nothing to do with even some of the prominent American Jewish organizations. So there is something that is very disconcerting about who these people are. I don't know the exact identity of these people, but I do know that there was one video that was publicized on Twitter, a man by the name of Aaron Cohen, who is formerly with the Israeli Defense Forces, was parading with the L.A. Sheriff's Department as they were taking down the pro-Palestinian encampment May 1st, the day after the attack on the pro-Palestinian protesters. That's when law enforcement moved in to take down the encampments because there was violence. Obviously, the violence was from the other side, but the pro-Palestinian protesters suffered and were targeted by law enforcement that night. So he was claiming that he has been embedded with L.A. Sheriff's Department, and he is a veteran of the Israeli Defense Force, and he trains L.A. Sheriff's Department on counterterrorism, and he called the encampment an anti-Semitic pro-terrorist encampment. So you have signs of pro-Israel infiltration of U.S. law enforcement there. There are also several pictures that we have seen of L.A. Police Department officials with Israeli Defense Forces officers, some of them even going to Israel and posing next to the bombs that were going to be used against Palestinians and being proud of being there with the Israeli Defense Forces. So that in and of itself should cause us concern as Americans that law enforcement is being influenced by a foreign government. I don't care which foreign government, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Israel, Russian, what have you. But now, in this case, it is Israeli Defense Forces that are influencing law enforcement to target pro-Palestinian protesters, which, first of all, should never happen in our country where we have any foreign government influencing law enforcement, but it is happening. And I'm part of a task force with the Department of Homeland Security on transnational repression, where foreign governments come in to repress anybody that is considered a political dissident by calling them terrorists. And my point to in this task force is that we should not be concerned with adversaries, which the focus of transnational repression is usually placed. We should be concerned with allies that exploit counterterrorism policy to foment repression against political dissidents, and that is exactly what's happening here in America, as we've seen in terms of the repression of pro-Palestinian protesters by pro-Israel elements, whether here in the United States or from Israel itself.
Let me ask you, MPAC has demanded that UCLA itself be held accountable for, quote, failing to protect the physical safety and First Amendment rights of peaceful student protesters who faced injuries from physical attacks and aggression. How, in particular, did UCLA fail to fulfill its responsibilities regarding both physical safety and free speech rights of all of the students?
Yes, that's a great question, Stephen. And first and foremost, UCLA and the chancellor himself considered the peaceful encampment to be illegal. And it is not illegal. It is protected by the First Amendment that we have the right to assemble, especially on property that is being funded by our tax dollars. That is public property. And this, the notion that, well, they were impeding people from getting to classes. Really? An extra 5 minutes? You know, Palestinians have to take a day now with the checkpoints that is imposed on them by Israeli settlers and Israeli Defense Forces in the West Bank, for example. So to get to the hospital, for example, or to get to any appointment sometimes takes hours. And I think these encampments are making the point that, you know, we're going to do a little bit of inconvenience here to make you understand what Palestinians are going through. And we are standing up against genocide. And so these students are speaking their conscience. I was hoping that some of these school officials, you know, some of them would have embraced these students and joined, you know, just like we would join anyone that would do an encampment for the Ukraine or join some groups that were working for Darfur and the genocide there, or the Rwandan genocide, or what happened in the Balkans, or all these incidents. We embrace students that act on their conscience and are enacting what we have been teaching them all these years during their schooling, and that is you need to stand up for justice. Look at Martin Luther King. Look at what happened in Eastern Europe and the winds of change, and look at what happened in terms of the anti-Vietnam campaigns, the anti-Vietnam War protests. And so we teach them all this history, and then we expect them to just sit there and do nothing. That's hypocrisy on the part of the U.S., on the UCLA officials and school administrators. They should have been defending the First Amendment rights of these students. Instead, they violated the First Amendment rights of these students, and that is why we find the UCLA chancellor culpable for what happened that night, because the whole culture, I don't know exactly what happened and who was communicating to whom, but the whole culture was to attack and target and vilify the pro-Palestinian encampments. Who should be vilified, really, in my opinion, are the people that are committing genocide against the Palestinian people. Those are the real villains, and the president himself of the United States allowing this to go on, even to this day, what's happening in Rafah. He said there's a red line, and now he keeps moving that, making it so that there's no red line, there's no accountability for the Israeli Defense Forces to continue to massacre Palestinians each and every day, and then we're expected to say nothing about it.
Well, Salam, the Muslim Public Affairs Council has also called on the federal government, the U.S. Department of Justice, to immediately investigate the Los Angeles Police Department's handling of the UCLA protest. What prompted your call for that investigation? And have you heard anything from the DOJ?
We haven't heard anything concrete yet, but we're still pressing, and we're very hopeful that something will come out in the near future. But yes, not only L.A. Police Department, but L.A. Sheriff's Department, the UC University of California Police Department, should all be investigated. And any individual that was either committing a dereliction of duty in protecting Americans, protecting students, or actually involved by allowing pro-Israel infiltrators and agitators to do what they did for 3 hours, mind you, 3 hours, and standing by and not doing anything, that in and of itself should raise concern that there's something wrong and something needs to be investigated. So, yes, we are calling for investigation of law enforcement because, you know, I don't know if you're aware of this. I think Stephen is. Law enforcement likes to come to our community gatherings and do the community relations and say that, you know, we're all together and we're all Americans and we want to have positive community relations through dialogue. There can be no dialogue. There can be nothing that can be business as usual after what happened on April 30th. And that's the message we gave to law enforcement. And so even LAPD informed us that they are putting more resources into the investigation of the culprits of April 30th, the agitators. But we're calling on the federal government to do investigation of law enforcement.
Salam, how do you see what happened at UCLA fitting into a national pattern on these college campuses? And do you see a double standard at work at our universities when it comes to those voicing support for Israel and those voicing support for Palestinian rights?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's part of, unfortunately, it's part of the political culture of the United States that we enable pro-Israel voices everywhere, in media, in politics, in Congress. I mean, look what's happening in Congress. It's just ridiculous what this Republican House of Representatives is doing by exploiting and really, as if they really care about the Jewish people. You have the worst anti-Semites among them and the groups that they support, like the Proud Boys, and yet they're coming and acting as if they're going to be the champions in combating anti-Semitism. And with that, of course, is the squelching of any pro-Palestinian voice. So if you have a pro-Palestinian voice in government, it's usually ridiculed, marginalized, castigated for being an anti-Semite. Same thing in academia. I go and speak on campuses. They'll have the Israeli ambassador, and they put their video up front on their website. But people like myself or other pro-Palestinian voices go and speak, they don't even publish the video. But they usually they just put it as a they're checking the box. Okay, we allowed the pro-Palestinian voices to come and have their say. So when we're talking about dialogue in America, and this is something that's very important in terms of interfaith relations, we cannot look at it as having any parity. It's just like there's no parity of power between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The Israelis have all the power, military power, international power, support, and financial support by the United States. And so if they commit a violation, like they do every day in the West Bank, the most that they'll get is the United States saying that they shouldn't do that. But Palestinians commit any violations, there's immediate punishment against the Palestinian people, like, for example, taking away UNRWA and any food and humanitarian assistance for the Palestinians that the United States itself was involved in dismantling of UNRWA. It is reflected here in America. It is mirrored in America where anybody, and you know, I even received this information from staff members in the U.S. Congress. They said, if you come here and you try to do a forum on Palestinians, that will be that you will get the same effect, the same reaction as if you're urinating on a wall. That's how bad it is in terms of trying to speak for the Palestinian issue in our current American political culture.
Salam, are you concerned that criticism of Israel and Zionism is being conflated with anti-Semitism?
It's already happening. We have been criminalized for speaking for Palestinians. Immediately, what happened for defending Palestinian rights? Our views are being conflated with Hamas views. So if you're pro-Palestinian, all of a sudden you're pro-Hamas. So right there, that's criminalization. And that's conflating any criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. Or if you're involved in the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement, BDS. They want to make that a criminal act. But that, in BDS movement, is part of nonviolent resistance. What do we mean by nonviolent resistance? People say, you know, the Palestinians should stop being violent. They should engage in nonviolent resistance, and then the whole world will support them. Baloney. Nobody will support them, other than the governments of South Africa and now a few brave countries coming out supporting Palestinian statehood. But nobody is supporting nonviolent resistance. And then when violence happens, then people are aghast and they're horrified and they're outraged. How dare the Palestinians become violent? Well, you have shut every nonviolent way to achieving a solution. You shut everything down in terms of achieving Palestinian statehood and saying that that's anti-Semitism. You know, in 1988, I was part of the California Democratic Party. In my naivete, thought we can go and get a resolution supporting Palestinian statehood. And so I spoke for that resolution. And a congressman by the name of Henry Waxman stood up and immediately said, no, we will not support that because that is anti-Semitism. So they voted that resolution down in 1988. And so we've been used to that. Whatever we do, we've been called anti-Semites. Whatever we do, we've been called terrorists. Whatever we do, we've been called even anti-American. And that game is over. We are not going to just let that slide from now on. We're going to call it out for what it is. It is anti-Palestinian bigotry is the reality. You hate Palestine, and that's why you're calling what we're doing criminal. Because you cannot stand to see anybody having a pro-Palestinian voice in America, other than maybe, you know, a movie here or there or an article here or there, or we bring somebody from Israel-Palestine and say, look at the dialogue. That's actually now, there's a name, a term for that in interfaith circles. It's called faith washing, using interfaith dialogue as a way of whitewashing crimes against the Palestinian people. And so all this anti-Semitism legislation that the Congress is coming up with, it has nothing to do with combating anti-Semitism. It will exacerbate anti-Semitism, actually, because people are going to see this as an exploitation against people that want to defend their First Amendment rights and say that this is wrong, say that this is genocide. Even calling it genocide now is being called, is responded to by calling what we're saying is anti-Semitic. So, yeah, there is a big problem. And first and foremost is we are shredding the Constitution once again, just like it was done after the Patriot Act. And now they're doing it in the name of combating anti-Semitism. So we're a long ways from seeing any resolution to this. There needs to be more discussions. I appreciate the time on this program to talk about it, but definitely we're going to see more student activism on this. And as Martin Luther King said, you know, his friends, his white moderates that he had problems with, they care more about order than they care about justice. So I'm really glad that you've named this program Law and Disorder, because we need a little more disorder and agitation to show people what's wrong with the system and the status quo that is enabling war crimes against a people with our tax dollars and with our government providing international protection and military aid to be part of that genocide. And so when we talk about international humanitarian law or any accountability on the international arena, our government now is acting against that and is acting against the Constitution, in my opinion. And therefore, we're looking for a peace, as Martin Luther King said, not with the absence of tension, but with the presence of justice.
Salaam, what you just said is so important. People mix the notion of criticizing Israel because it's a Jewish state, and they say, therefore, you're criticizing Jews and criticizing Judaism, and that's anti-Semitic. Can you unpack that? And what's the distinction between the two?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, Stephen. You know, historically, Islam protected Jews. Islam is the religion that actually brought Jews back to Jerusalem after the Roman Empire had fallen and the Muslims took over Jerusalem because the Byzantines, the Romans, had actually annihilated the Jewish population there. And so we, you know, as Muslims, the Quran says you're supposed to protect Jews and Christians as people of the book, and that's what many of the Muslim rulers had done for 1,300 years. And in fact, one famous story, again, after a tragedy, the Spanish Inquisition, the Ottomans took in about 200,000 to 300,000 Jews from the Iberian Peninsula and brought them to what we now know as Turkey. And many other Jews went to North Africa, and hence the term Sephardim, Sephardic Jews came. So Islam and Judaism have never had a conflict. And so this issue that somehow, because we're pro-Palestinian, we're anti-Semitic, it has no logic, has no reasonable, rational foundation to it. We are against the apartheid racist policies of a government that is harming people who have been living there for over 1,000 years. We defy this false classification of Arab versus Jew. There are Arab Jews, and there are Jews who are not Zionists, or there are Jews who are critical of Israel. So it's not about Muslim versus Jew or Arab versus Jew. It's really about those who want to see justice in Israel-Palestine and those who want to continue with the status quo, which is now almost completing an ethnic cleansing of Gaza, which all Americans of conscience should be standing up against.
Well, Salaam, thank you so much for that. Where can listeners find out more about MPAC and what they can do to confront the silencing of Muslim and pro-Palestinian voices?
Thank you for asking that question. You can go to our website, Muslim Public Affairs Council, M as in Muslim, P as in Public, A as in Affairs, C as in Council, mpac.org, and you'll find all the information there. We'll be having a conference, I believe, June 23rd. Please look for that, on the silencing of our voices and standing up for the First Amendment. And we're involved in a lot of activities. We'll be having a national policy conference next week in Washington, D.C., addressing some of these issues as well. And we have a Hollywood bureau that is attempting to take back our narrative and influence Hollywood in a way that allows these voices to be heard for the American people.
Salaam, thank you so much for being with us on Law and Disorder, and thank you so much for everything you do when you wake up and do the work. Thank you very much.
I appreciate it, Stephen. I really appreciate the opportunity here. Thank you so much, everybody.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. In early May, New York Police Department officers demolished pro-Palestinian encampments and arrested 56 student protesters at New York University and the New School. Officials at both institutions enlisted the police in assisting the tearing down of tents. The NYU encampment was at the John Paulson Center on Bleecker Street. Professors there released a statement condemning the decision to call in the municipal police, dubbing it, quote, another shameful moment in NYU history that had put students at risk. NYU's Palestine Solidarity Coalition posted on social media, quote, we have seen 7 months of targeting pro-Palestinian speech on this campus and thus cannot agree with the admin's claims of acting in good faith. Supporting student protesters at several New York City campuses has been political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was called in by phone to address them from Mahanoy State Prison in Pennsylvania. Mumia has told students that they are on the right side of history by electing not to be silent and to speak out. Joining us today to discuss his experience at the NYU encampment and his subsequent arrest is Javier Fitzsimmons-Cruz. Javier recently earned his master's degree at NYU, and this fall he will begin working towards his PhD in history at the City University of New York. Javier, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Heidi. Thank you so much for having me.
Why did you first join the protest against Israel's lethal attacks on Palestinians?
There are a lot of ways I could answer that. Plainly, I find the one-sided slaughter of innocent Palestinians repulsive. The core issue here is that using American tax dollars, the United States is enabling Israel's genocide in both Gaza and the West Bank. And with each massacre, the stakes of our complicity and silence grow. Today, we've reached a point in this decades-long ethnic cleansing where the reasons to resist are laid out very clearly for us. No amount of propaganda can masquerade this carnage as some sort of complex political issue. I protest for the same reason people protested apartheid in South Africa, or the American invasion of Vietnam, or Jim Crow in the American South. Every day in Gaza is another My Lai massacre, and every day there's another Emmett Till in the West Bank. We are being put on trial, morally and spiritually, as witnesses to this horror and we have to act.
Javi, what do you think this conflict means for your generation, and how does it color your understanding of the university and what the university is committed to doing?
This is a very defining moment for my generation. We're seeing the reality of U.S. foreign policy. We're watching a genocide unfold before our eyes. And the idea of the United States as a moral or a benevolent political actor is disappearing. Young people are seeing how liberal politics can only take you so far to solve the problems that we are confronting. Our democratic institutions are failing us. The majority of Americans disapprove of Israel's actions in Gaza, but we are chained to a Congress and a president who has not just failed to consider the value of Palestinian lives, but also the demands of their own citizens. Every generation has its defining moment where what they see is in clear contradiction to what they're being told. The assumptions we once understood about our so-called democratic institutions are being undone. This moment is so important for us because this generation is learning that if you want serious, popular change, you've got to organize, disrupt, and rebel. And spaces like universities should never be exempt from that. They should always be democratic spaces that we should feel empowered to make change in.
So well said. Help us imagine what it was like in the encampment. What did it mean to you and your fellow students? Can you share a few moments about what daily life was like?
Yeah, and I'll start by just reiterating what the demands of the encampment were, which was, like many others, divesting from companies with ties to Israel and those that profit from war and genocide, academically boycotting Israel, closing NYU's academic center in Tel Aviv, ending NYU's policy of allowing MIPD on campus, and granting amnesty to students speaking out against Israel's genocide. NYU's encampment saga was unique and really interesting. There were two camps. The first encampment was at Gould Plaza on West 4th Street, and the second was at 181 Mercer Street. The Gould Plaza encampment was brutally raided and dismantled during its first night. Almost 200 students and professors were arrested, and a wall was built around the site of the encampment for the rest of the semester. I don't know if it's still up, but it was up throughout graduation week and last time I was there. Just, plywood, just a wooden wall around where the encampment first went up. Despite that, under threat of more police brutality, arrest, suspension, expulsion, the incredible organizers, student organizers at NYU, started another encampment days later on 181 Mercer Street. And the first day saw a similar police response to the Gould Plaza camp. And leadership struck an interesting deal with NYPD and NYU administration, which is university administration, which is that if we turned over our tents, we wouldn't be raided. That was the deal. And the idea was obviously to make living in the encampment as challenging and difficult and horrible as possible. On top of these looming threats, of suspension and, having your academic career ruined and potentially having your career ruined and your future complicated and expulsion, on top of all those things, I'm sure the expectation from our president, Linda Mills, and NYPD was the encampment will disperse. It did not. And in those conditions, I learned what solidarity looks like from these students who remained utterly unfazed, who chose to sleep on hard, cold concrete because there's no lawn, there's no grass. We weren't in a building. And they did that while risking their futures. And all of that meant nothing to them when we thought about what was happening in Gaza. So in the days following the establishment of the second encampment, we suffered through the elements: rain, drizzle, wind, cold, without tents, but with enormous community support. People brought pillows, blankets, restaurants catered food, breakfast, lunch, and dinner each night, each day. And community members, they made darn sure the camp was stocked and supported. And they made darn sure that if the NYPD showed up, they were there. On May Day, the huge labor march started downtown in Manhattan, went to Washington Square Park, and rallied around our encampment. And it brought thousands of people. Thousands of working people from across the city came to support us and show their solidarity with the people, with Palestinians in Gaza. And it was incredible. Throughout the day-to-day in the encampment, we had reading circles, teach-ins, lots of music. There was a Free People's Library, art builds, poetry readings. Every day there were community meetings, town halls, updates on what was happening in Gaza. Mumia's speech was preceded by a teach-in on Irish-Palestinian solidarity, a music performance by the legendary Egyptian artist Rami Assam, and a teach-in on urban gardening. The NYU Gaza Solidarity Encampment was a loving, uplifting, educational, empowering environment. It was everything a university should be. It represented those who struggle against complicity in a genocide, meant reimagining what a university should be and who it should serve. And it was truly a people's university.
I want to remind our listeners that this is Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with Javier Fitzsimmons Cruz. I'm Michael Smith. My co-host Heidi Boghossian is with me. Javier, did you visit any other encampments in the city?
I did. I was a friend and I tried arranging a care package for Columbia, the Columbia encampment, a couple of days after it was established. But the perimeter of the security made it so impossible to get inside or, you know, get anything inside. So instead, when CCNY encampment went up the following day, we rushed uptown together and dropped off snacks, batteries, a cooler, ice, water, lots of over-the-counter medication, medicine, masks, and whatever else we could think of. This was I think a day before NYU's encampment went up. And then I returned to CCNY the night it was dismantled by NYPD, which was a bitter, bitter scene. It was after NYPD brutally raided Columbia and CCNY's encampment that we snuck our tents back in. And that was when we finally, after I think 4 or 5 days, we said, well, let's just pitch the tents again. But yeah, I was lucky enough. And then I went to, you couldn't get into the new schools, but that was right up the street from us. And they had a beautiful encampment as well.
Now, you mentioned political prisoner, scholar, author Mumia Abu-Jamal, who called in by phone the night before the encampment was shut down, and his call was routed to your phone. Tell us how that felt.
That was quite overwhelming. It was surreal. I mean, it felt like I had a lightning rod in my hand. It was beautiful. I couldn't believe it, because, I mean, one of the things is we're taught about the Panthers and the Lords and the Young Lords and the civil rights icons and organizations as if they're a part of some bygone era. But they're still with us. And the violent state apparatus that silenced them in the 60s, 70s, and 80s is also still with us. Mumia, of course, represents that more than most. there was, I mean, I can't describe how hectic that day was. I remember having to, you know, plan the, you know, this call while we were out of batteries for our phones. You know, we were running low on everything. We you know, it was the day after the Columbia siege and the CCNY siege. So we were anticipating, you know, we're probably next. And we were trying to figure out, you know, kind of what to do. And there were a lot of Zionist antagonizers who were screaming from, you know, the outside. So it was it was hectic, but maybe we'll get into this in a minute. But his speech was seriously impactful. It was much more impactful because of that.
Tell us what effect Mumia's remarks had on you and your fellow students. And is the recording still available?
So, yeah, like I said, I can't stress enough how chaotic that day was for me in particular. The next morning, the morning of our arrest, I had to present my dissertation, my master's thesis. So I went straight from getting arrested to doing that. And the police took my keys and everything, so I couldn't even get back to my apartment. I just had to go from point A to point B. So for me, you know, that whole experience was really chaotic. And, you know, it was so hard to regroup after that. So the recording does exist. I just need to find the right people. But like I said, there were agitators outside screaming. There were, you know, we were running low on battery. We didn't have enough battery for our big mic. So we all huddled around in the middle of the encampment, and someone got a small microphone out, and we just pressed my phone up against the microphone. And we all got as tight as possible and as quiet as possible. And we had a line of people with umbrellas facing the agitators, so they couldn't see in, and we kind of muted the noise. We were all understandably on edge, anxious about, we kind of knew what was coming. But Mumia reminded us the footsteps we walked in, that change only comes with struggle. He reminded us of the lunacy of our inevitable punishment for the crime of protesting genocide, for having hearts, minds, and souls that refuse to accept the slaughter and destruction of Gaza.
I heard that NYU students who were arrested had to write a letter. Is that accurate? And what did they say, if they did?
It's true, which was sort of one of the most outrageous parts of the experience, was having to, you know, students having to write an apology letter that not only assumed their guilt in everything, you know, having to admit what you did was wrong and who you harmed, but it was just an act of punishment and humiliation. That's really what it was just trying to humiliate people. And I haven't read anyone, you know, they were due, I think they're due soon. They're due today or yesterday. So I have not caught up with everyone in terms of what they've been writing. But, I mean, it was really a punitive move that was so inappropriate and so just pathetic by the university.
A friend, Professor Johanna Fernandez, said she saw a post on Twitter saying this letter writing was the only respectable use of ChatGPT.
I agree.
Javier, let me ask you this. The central political question, of course, is always, what do you do next? What's your thinking about what we all should be doing next?
Well, escalation, continuing to escalate, continuing to dig in. You know, we're now in a protracted struggle. We're now a part of a broader protracted struggle, growing our networks of solidarity, which is how you build a movement, how movement survives. That's all we can do. This movement will continue. Next, I'm sure in the fall, there will be more encampments. There'll be more escalation. There'll be more everything. It's going to be a hot summer in New York City, that's for sure.
You gave a really eloquent introduction to the moral reasons for protesting the ongoing genocide of Palestinians. But if you were to meet someone or someone in our audience isn't really aware of the extent of the atrocities, how would you succinctly urge them of the seriousness of this and how to get involved?
Well, I'm always reminded of James Baldwin's words, every bomb village is my hometown. The first thing we have to do is acknowledge our shared humanity and see ourselves with the oppressed people of the world. And, I mean, we have to see this as even more of a connecting our foreign policy issues with our domestic ones. It's utterly outrageous that we're sending tens of billions of dollars to bomb refugee camps when you consider the dire state of the American working class and our neediest people here. Every bomb dropped on innocent people in Gaza is a choice to invest in death over investing in good-paying jobs, schools, healthcare, and more. When we make these connections, we're challenging the priorities of our government. We're imagining a better world that we can achieve together. And if your politic is anti-racist, anti-war, anti-apartheid, anti-poverty, homelessness, if your heart cries indignation at the slaughter of innocent people, then you are already with us. And you're always welcome to join. It is never too late.
Javier, tell us, though, what are your plans now that you've graduated with a master's from NYU?
I am going to start my PhD in history at the CUNY Grad Center with your friend, Joanna Fernandez.
We wish you all the best of luck. We look forward to seeing you back in the streets in September and hope to have you once again on Law and Disorder with an update.
We look forward to seeing you in the streets, and we look forward to joining you.
Thank you guys so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you. Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Hi, it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk, they hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
You are listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
I go out walking after midnight, out in the moonlight, just like we used to do. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you. I walk for miles along the highway. Well, that's just my way of saying I love you. I'm always walking after midnight, searching for you. I stop to see a weeping willow crying on his pillow. Maybe he's crying for me. And as the skies turn gloomy, night winds whisper to me, I'm lonesome as I can be. I go out walking after midnight, out in the starlight, hoping you may be somewhere a-walking after midnight, searching for me. Night.
Help me, I'm falling in love with you. Close the door to temptation. Don't let me walk through. Turn away from me, darling. I'm begging you. With you, I know that I'm losing.